Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today we have a variety of topics for the program. We're going to get started. Why am I so funny?
I don't know. It's just a variety.
We do.
Are we doing a variety show? Or are we going to be singing and it's dancing?
No dancing. Only dancing for charity causes.
Yeah.
Dancing doesn't translate on the radio.
Right. Makes me think of Carol Burnett. I loved Carol Burnett. Oh, my gosh.
Now, that would be a fun, what are Carol Burnett's favorite things to eat and drink?
Ooh, and I would love to talk with her about food. She's so cool.
If listeners want us to go after the Carol Burnett food and wine interview, we will go after it if you tell us. You can reach out to us at formanwolf@wypr.org. But back to the task at hand, which is to tell you what we're doing. We have coming up very shortly Bill Sweet from Winderly Vineyards, terrific producer in Oregon, talking about recent vintages and what's going on right now, what's happening this time of the year. All around us in Baltimore, we see, you know, flowers on trees. What does that mean for wine growers?
Yes. I'm excited to hear what he has to say.
And also, there's a lot of nervousness also at this time of the year for wine growers. So
frost.
Exactly, among other things. That'll be interesting to hear. And then I know that Cindy has a couple of particular recipes she wants to get across.
That's right.
We'll slide those somewhere into the middle of the second segment.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say what they are. It's a secret.
Oh, secret recipes from Cindy Wolf. Oh, boy. Uh-huh. The OSS will come get them from her in the second segment.
Oh, gosh.
And headed into the third segment, we have a couple of chef challenges. We wanted to do things with a particular angle. I think there may be a certain amount of, like, revenge challenge involved in some of these.
Okay. So, well, now I know that part. I didn't know that part before.
But we'll get started here with the interview with Bill Sweet. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Tony?
Good. We were just chatting about how interesting it's going to be to hear
all of the
emotional crisis that is the spring and a high-quality, high-stakes vineyard. So what makes the winter set up the spring correctly for you?
Yeah, so, first of all, we'd like the vines to go dormant if we can. It makes for better pruning the sap recede, so we get less impact, potential impact on disease, for example. But also just gives the vines a rest in between growing seasons. And then Oregon is the place, where we only get about 40 inches of rain a year, but we get it all in the winter. And so the last couple of years, we've seen very dry winters and very low snowpack winters. And so water tables have started to recede a little bit. But we had good rainfall this year. And good snowpack, and so those tables are filling back up. So we're generally pretty fortunate. We can get through the entire growing season most years without using irrigation.
That's terrific. So winter is setting you up, and so what exactly is going on right now in this part of the spring, and what do you expect to happen in the course of the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, so we're very close to bud break. We have obvious buds. In fact, I'm on the road right now. I'm in Georgia, but my staff sent me some photos this morning. We don't have leaf separation yet, so we're not quite calling bud break, but we're very close. It'll be in the next several days. So we'll be a bit above, ahead of schedule. On average in the Northern Willamette Valley, we usually consider about April 15th to be typical. Last year, we were March 23rd at our place. This year, it looks like we'll probably be April, 1st through 3rd-ish. So we're getting a little earlier start. And so a lot of the growing season will occur during the cooler, parts of the spring rather than later into the summer. And usually, that shapes up to mean that we're going to have harvest mostly in September. Going back again to the fact that we get winter rains, hopefully knock wood means we'll get harvest done before we start to see a lot of rain activity in the valley.
So winter setting you up with a decent water table and bud break coming a little bit early should set you up for a long, cool growing season with pretty good concentration and harvesting, not at times when you get diluted.
I think we'll mostly see harvest in September, probably pushing maybe into the middle of October, you know, if all things, you know, all things being equal, as I say, in economics. And so it increases the likelihood that we'll get harvest done without rains. It looks like we're in a kind of a El Nino period now, but most of the weather's actually been affected by this water blob in the West Coast, which has been warmer than average over the last several years, but has just recently unexpectedly cooled down. So the thinking is that that's going to drop the minimum temperature, so we'll get nice diurnal shifts. We'll get a big drop between daytime temperatures and nighttime temperatures, which is really nice for grapes. Helps us to retain natural acidity.
Since you guys grow Pinot and are so focused on Pinot, in site to site, you're in the same area, but site to site, you have soil changes. You also have exposure changes. Do you find in the spring that bud break happens at different times, that different sites winter over a little bit different than other sites? Coming to this time of the year, how diverse, those little individual pieces of terroir, how diverse are just those little incremental differences, and how much do they affect what you think the long-term raw product is coming out from the Pinot vineyards?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of examples. So, we're in Dundee, Oregon, where our vineyard is 80% south-facing, a little bit south by southwest. We're in a warm bowl. One of the vineyards that we buy fruit from is immediately to our south, about 100 yards from the edge of our vineyard, and is east-facing. And it's not unusual for that vineyard to have bud break a week or more after us, and to have harvest a week or more after us. And it's 100 yards away. That south-facing versus east-facing makes a big difference in this particular case. We also farm a vineyard called Meredith Mitchell Vineyard in the McMinnville AVA, which is a cooler site, gets a lot of cool ocean air through the Van Duser Corridor, a little windier than our place, and that vineyard always starts and ends later than our vineyard as well. So very, very micro climate related issues can have a big impact on when things start and finish, and the quality of the fruit as well.
And are there certain years where certain soil types seem to thrive, or with different weather patterns, or not necessarily?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's probably more related to weather than it is to soil. But I'm not expert enough in soil to tell you that that's entirely true. I think what we're seeing, though, is more that the kind of the microclimate for each of the sites where we buy fruit is really the telling factor rather than the geology, at least vintage to vintage.
I would think that would be a giant factor. I think to remind Cindy of what fantastic things that you all make, can you take a moment and describe something you all have recently produced that she should be drinking that maybe she hasn't had access to yet?
Yeah, so, very interesting. So we've started just a couple of years ago making a Pinot Blanc from the Meredith Mitchell Vineyard, which we've been leasing for the last couple of years, and which we farm biodynamic, like we farm our state vineyard. And that Pinot Blanc has been very interesting. I ordered a clay amphora for the last two vintages, and we've been doing up to about 40% of the élevage in clay, and that has created an entirely different mouthfeel and characteristic than either the neutral oak or the stainless steel that we've been using. So I think that's a very interesting wine, and something we've only been producing 2 years now, so it's quite unusual for our lineup.
You're a madman, Bill. Can you explain the reason that you wanted to use an amphora, And for listeners who are not familiar, a clay amphora, imagine things that from the time of ancient Greece were used to ship olive oil or used to ship wine. They were large ceramic, definitely neutral, non-porous vessels for products, and has been one of the hotter things in certain places in the wine-growing world, in Friuli, for example, or in Sicily for some time.
Yeah, it's good. You know, if you go, you know, back to the you know, millennia, it's probably the original fermentation vessel.
If you go back to Mykonos, it's the original fermentation vessel.
Even back before, for sure. For me, it's this is all just a great learning process. Like, you know, it's exciting to me. I'm 58 years old now to be doing something where I can continue to learn and to try new things is great fun. My undergraduate degree is history, so I love the idea of doing things in ways which are traditional, and clay is about as traditional as you get. I've really been interested in trying to understand a bit about the impact of clay on wine. It ended up that we ended up using the clay in the Pinot Blanc. I had originally intended to use the amphora in garage wine I make under the tasting room, which is we call Imprint, which is 100% whole cluster, and is really kind of the most traditional winemaking we do. Very low intervention, you know, biodynamic farming, biodynamic winemaking, native fermentations. And I thought the amphora would be perfect for that, but it was delivered when I was traveling and we didn't have a forklift. And so we had it brought down to our winery facility in McMinnville. And while it was there, we thought, oh, this probably would be perfect for Pinot Blanc. Let's try it in that first. And so that's how we made the transition to using the clay and the Pinot Blanc.
Are the amphoras in the ground?
They are not, no. They're above ground.
Do you have clay in your soil there?
The soils in most of the vineyards where we buy fruit are Jorey soils, which is a clay loam soil.
Interesting. I think that's very cool that you've decided to do that. A trip that we took to Sicily to see that it was really brilliant to see. So good, all the best with that.
Yeah, have you ever seen the winery Kos or photographs from there? You see that all the fermentations are in amphora. The amphora are all buried in the lava rock.
I'm always in awe to try to figure out how they get the pomace out of those things with them buried and, you know, up to their necks. It's definitely a act of love because I'm sure it's incredibly labor intensive.
Giant pain in the backside is another way of translating that.
So, can I ask you a basic question about wine growing?
Yeah.
When you planted your vines, how long before you produced your first wine? How long does it take?
Yeah. So the vineyard that we purchased had already been planted. Original sections were from 74, 75, 76. And then there were some newer plantings from between 1998 and 2005. We have since replanted some sections because we have phylloxera on the vineyard. And those old 70s-era vines are own-rooted. So we lost a couple of blocks. Mm-hmm. And so we've been replanting about 2¾ acres. And typically, it's about 3 years. And the third year, we call it third leaf, you'll get a usable crop. Typically, it's about half of what you would consider to be a commercial crop in terms of yield. And then year four, you'll get a more normal crop. And I think probably by years, you know, six, seven, and eight, you're at the point where you feel like you have fruit which is consistent and starting to reflect the place where it's grown.
What do you do with the grapes until they're productive?
So typically we don't allow the vines for the first 3 years to produce grapes.
Okay.
We'll drop all the fruit off. And because we want the vines to focus their energy on developing a root system.
Okay.
And then we'll usually in the third year we'll see if it looks like the vines are growing a sufficient enough canopy that we think they can carry a little bit of fruit. Then we'll leave a little bit of fruit on.
Thank you. Interesting.
You're welcome.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for giving us a call and giving us a snapshot of what's going on. Sounds like things are setting up for a good 16 for you all.
I think so. Fingers crossed. You know, I think it's a lot like, college basketball. Everything happens in the last 2 minutes, so we'll see.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, boy.
Now you made me nervous for you.
All the best to you. Well, we hope all good things happen for you, so.
Well, thank you so much. We'll keep our fingers crossed and just continue to do what we do.
Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
If people want to reach you or take a look at Winderly, what Winderly does, do you want to provide a web address?
Yes, www.winderly.com, and Winderly is spelled W-I-N-D-E-R-L-E-A.
Very good.
Yeah, Winderly is definitely one of the handful of very best qualitative producers of Pinot Noir in Oregon for
my
choice.
Yeah, we love your wine.
That's no question.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your support.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Bye now.
Well, that was great to talk to Bill. I'm excited to see what 16s are going to be like.
Oh, absolutely. That's good news. I'm glad to hear for him that their water table has improved. And I just know how they've suffered so much out west
Oregon,
with their rainfall. So
Oregon's tricky vintage-wise.
I'm sure.
Yeah, no question.
Oh, my goodness. Any farming anywhere is tricky. So all the best to them.
When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we have chef's challenges, a few recipes. And didn't we say revenge challenge?
You did. Okay.
All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, you know, we did that salad program last week,
mm-hmm.
and I feel a little irresponsible.
How so?
Are you laughing because I should feel irresponsible?
I just don't understand.
Well, because we're telling people, like, the best or, you know, mm-hmm. most way to do X, Y, Z.
Did we miss something?
We didn't. A lot of people do think of salads as being green salads.
Right.
We didn't talk about washing greens. A lot of people are going to farmers markets and they're buying product at farmers markets and things come right off farms, and which is great because you're going to get freshness, and but you're also going to get...
It's going to be dirty.
And you're going to get...
Bugs.
And you're going to get twigs and you're going to get rocks. And you're
right.
Gonna, okay.
Yeah. There's all kinds of natural things in there.
Yeah, you need to have a deep relationship with your sink and running water.
And hopefully a deep sink is actually the key to all that.
So to wash out greens. So
what we
give them a couple of steps.
Yeah, I mean, thank goodness we have commercial sinks. So it's nice to have a gigantic sink, which is also why I just put a commercial sink in my new kitchen in my house.
If you don't have a commercial sink, go to Cindy's house and wash out your greens.
Please don't do that.
Anything else that they should use?
No. So maybe if you have a tiny sink for some reason, you get a bus tub. I mean, I would do something. I would come up with some sort of a vessel.
Bus tub translates into large plastic box.
Yeah. But if you have a good size sink, then just, you know, fill it up with cold water. And you have to be, you know, most lettuce, when you talk about lettuce, they're tender. They're delicate. So you have to work with it gently. And you want to fill up, and always cold water, obviously, never warm or... And this is always a challenge a little bit in the summertime because our water isn't necessarily as cold as it is in the wintertime coming out of the tap. And if it's not cold enough, at the restaurant, we'll even put ice cubes in the sink to make sure that the water is extremely cold. And just large amounts of water, put your greens in. They're prepped, whether they're already cut. You've just cut them on a board and gone into the sink, or you're simply have removed the root of the greens and you're just opening up the greens to let them wash clean. And maybe you're going to tear them. or leave them whole for that matter. Just make sure you gently swish them through the water and then lift the greens out and go into a colander or some sort of salad spinner, which honestly, those things are like a gift because you really don't want excess water on your greens. It ruins your salad. It ruins your dressing.
Well, sometimes greens from farms, I mean, you have to wash them 3 times.
Oh, I keep washing them until that sink is clear of sand or dirt. So you lift them out.
Yeah.
You let them drain. You wash out your sink. You clean your sink. Then you fill it up again, and you keep doing it until that is. And it should be 2 or 3 times at the most. I can't imagine having to wash them more than 3 times.
And there's some herbs that are the same, like cilantro. Almost always is the same way.
Oh, and those are really delicate, so you really have to handle them carefully. But just swish them around in there and lift them out, and then drain the water. Don't drain the dirty water back over the greens or the herbs or whatever or vegetables, whatever you're working with. I mean, with say zucchini or something that tends to grow in sandier soil or is more successful that way, that's something that you really have to kind of, you want to use a soft towel to just rub them down a little bit. Some things you can actually use a vegetable brush to clean into a lot of water and rinse them really well. But that's it. You know, with lettuces, it's just a matter of as much water as possible, lift them out, clean it, try it again, do it until the water is pretty clean.
Now you understand why I felt so irresponsible.
I see, yes.
Telling people how to make dressing and not telling them how to make sure the greens are clean.
Well, you did it. We did it.
Very
now.
Dangerous. Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, Tony, how do you pair wines with salads?
It's not so easy. It depends upon the salad itself and exactly how sharply it's dressed.
The vinegar is the problem? Is that?
Yeah. Vinegar can tend to be a pretty good issue because that's what spoils wine. So it's not so nice to have a really nice glass of wine and have a big sip in your mouth and have a bite of a salad, and that's the issue. If the wine has good acidity, meaning sharp acidity, you're probably going to be more successful with it. If the salad actually has something, if it's about something other than greens and a dressing, you know, if there's fat to it, if it's a salad where it's, you know, potatoes involved, if it's something, there has to be something for the wine to hold on to in order to act with it.
Mm-hmm.
Things that have a tremendous amount of tannin are not going to be that successful. Things that are super duper crazy fruity are not going to be that successful. A little bit fruity, very good acidity, usually your best bets with most salads. Think about that your canasta lunch that you were proposing with the lobster salad and the nice Pinot Noir Rosé. That's kind of like a very good sweet spot to land in.
Okay.
So you have to be a little bit careful. I think that's really my best advice.
So I was thinking about one of the favorite things that I actually cooked this past week, which was a guinea fowl. And I don't know that is necessarily something that's super available to everyone, but you can certainly buy them online through different purveyors. But it is a bird that I think is very special. And it's a lean bird versus a duck that has a tremendous amount of fat underneath the skin.
Well, and it's a white meat bird.
It's a white meat bird, but yet it has
but
more flavor.
A huge amount of flavor.
Right. And I mean, I love chicken, so I am not saying anything about chicken. I'm just saying that a guinea fowl has more flavor than a chicken. The leg meat is a little bit darker, and there's less leg meat on a guinea fowl because they are really lean. And just the way they're built, their body bone structure. But I love, there are certain pockets of fat on a guinea fowl that sort of help to baste the bird naturally as it roasts. But I do typically, I just want to talk about roasting this bird because I think it's interesting because it is so lean. And when I made it, I actually put inside one bird, which probably weighed, I'd say, 3.5 to 4 pounds. I would put 2 cloves of garlic still in the skin, in the bird. And I put...
So you slivered the garlic and tucked into the skin?
No. In the cavity. I'm sorry.
In the cavity.
One small stem of rosemary in the cavity. And then I basically did 2 small slices off of an orange. So maybe a third of an orange went into the cavity. And I just put the slices in. I didn't squeeze it in there. And then I salted it and peppered it. And that perfumed that bird in such a pretty way.
And you salted and peppered inside and out.
And
right?
Outside, right. And I also brushed, because I had to butter poach garlic for another aspect of the dish. I had extra butter with that hint of garlic to it, and I brushed the outside of the bird with that butter, and I had to go back into the refrigerator before I roasted.
Because everyone hates extra garlic butter.
Right. So I had to go back into the refrigerator anyway, so I knew that would harden on the outside of the bird before it went into the oven and have a chance to really kind of get set to be roasted. And it browned beautifully. So I browned it in a 325-degree convection oven, and I roasted it for, I think total cook time was about 24 minutes. And you could always crank up your temperature to, say, 400, 425 if you're not getting the color that you really want from the birds. You could always do that at the end of the cooking. But this is a lean bird, so you want to be very careful. Once it's done, you really want to get it out of there. And you do want it to be cooked through. So I would say probably the perfect way to call that is medium well. Well done is going to be dry. And I even found that doing this bird that I took it out just a few minutes before that. One, you have some carryover cooking. It's not a big bird, but you will have some carryover, meaning that the bird is still hot coming out of the oven. So, of course,
the temperature
will
keep rising as the juice redistributes to the bird.
Right. And, of course, you want to allow all of that to happen. You want it to start to cool down. You want that juice to redistribute back through the bird. And then you want it to rest for probably a good 10 minutes. And I usually just take a piece of foil and just sort of loosely lay it over the bird so that it does, you know, retain temperature without containing the temperature completely. And then I removed everything from the interior cavity. That's basically trash. And then I made a pan sauce. So one of the ways that you can, I roasted in a en cocotte or in a cast iron pan finished with enamel. So like a stove pot or whatever. And what I could have done and did do actually near the end of the cooking process, instead of allowing it to cook all the way, I added a small dice of mirepoix to the pan, which was carrot, celery, and onion. I added whole cloves of small cloves of garlic, which I had butter poached, which gently cooks them so that they're ready to you don't want the garlic to brown or it will become bitter, and yet you want it cooked, obviously. And I added small shallots to that as well. And I added a small dice of button mushroom, and I threw in another piece of rosemary and a little bit of butter and just let that roast in. So there's two ways you can do it. You can either roast the bird and then serve it however you want, which is how I was describing it in the first place, or do this, which is near the end of the cooking. So the last 5 minutes of the cooking, add this mirepoix and everything, all these vegetables to the pan, and oh my goodness, it just perfumes the bird further, and it makes for a beautiful accompaniment, and also prepares you to do a really great pan sauce. So you take the bird out of that pan. When it's done, let it rest, and you can just, if your vegetables aren't completely done, work those a little bit on the stove, then remove the vegetables. There will be fat in there, so we actually drain them of the fat. And you can save that fat for something else for later, or you can discard it, whatever you would like to do. And then deglaze that pan with white wine. And we added I added a game stock reduction to that pan. You could add chicken stock, you could add veal stock, or a combination of different brown stocks, and make a pan sauce. Strain that onto the plate. You have your vegetable already made, and you carve your bird and plate it. And it was just really a pretty dish. And I think it's a great
guinea
dish for this time of the year.
Fantastic treat.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, you can apply
that. So, you know,
that.
I always make that for Christmas time. Mm-hmm. That's just a great treat.
Mm-hmm. So I was also thinking about two side dishes that I love with this bird. One is hoppenjohn. And because it is so traditional to Low Country cooking, I thought I would talk about how you make this dish. It's also called a perlo, and it is one of the most basic of all the perlo dishes in South Carolina. And it's a process of cooking black-eyed peas or crowder peas or field peas in a ham hock or bacon stock, basically. So you would, or fatback, whatever you would prefer to use. I like to use bacon. So I brown pieces of bacon, large pieces of bacon off. So that would be, you would be buying slab bacon. Cut it into 2-inch squares or 1-inch squares. Allow like 6 of those to brown really nicely in the pan, leaving the fat in the pan, and then add the small dice of 2 onions or 1 onion, depending on how much rice you're making. And then add, let's say, a 1-pound bag of black-eyed peas, a little bit of chicken stock, maybe twice the amount of chicken stock to the amount of peas, and a good bit of Tabasco and a little bit of pepper, and just let those peas cook. And that broth is going to become the foundation for making your rice. And that's what a perlo is. A perlo is a one-pot dish. So
to what point do you have to get the peas before you add the rice?
You want them to be soft. You want them to be finished. They're really not going to cook that much longer with
the peas, that soft, just soft.
Just soft. And also anytime you're working with dried bean, you should wash them several times until, again, they're clean and there's no signs of discoloration in the water. And then they really should soak overnight. Black-eyed peas have a pretty quick cook time, so you don't have to soak those overnight. Black beans, cocoa beans, those white beans, navy beans, they all should be soaked overnight. Actually, I'm going to say you don't have to soak the black-eyed peas overnight, but you do want to wash them well.
What you have to do is you get to that point where you have this kind of like porky oniony stew of that has maybe too much water or maybe too much stock rather, and the beans are just soft, and then you go with rice?
Yes, and then you add the rice to the pot. So you would just add whatever quantity of people you're cooking for, whatever you think you need, and add the rice, and the rice absorbs the cooking flavor and cooking water. Cover the pot, bring it up to a boil, cover the pot, turn the heat off, sit it on the back of the stove where it may be warm, and just let the rice do its thing. But that's Hoppin' John. And then another really good dish is a potato gratin. And particularly with the preparation I talked about with the guinea fowl, and the fact that you already have your oven on, you probably have room in there. You might as well put a gratin dish in there. And a potato gratin is a total art to me. I just love making it. And you can do it where it's really something that's kind of brilliant. And so a little bit of heavy cream in the bottom of a gratin dish, just enough to coat the bottom of the dish. And then just use your mandolin or slicer and just, you know, thinly slice your potatoes so that they're not paper thin, but just a little thicker than that. And then you begin to lay them in beautifully, a little salt and pepper in between layers, a little bit of Gruyere and Reggiano in between the layers. And I usually do five or six layers, alternating cream and then cheese, cream and then cheese. Be careful with your seasoning. Don't overdo it. You want to do it, but don't overdo it. And then you want to end up with a little bit of cream and cheese both on top. And then wrap it in foil. It usually takes about 45 minutes at 350 degrees and near the end of the cooking. Or when you reheat it, you can brown it. So that's a quick gratin. And I would use Yukon Gold potatoes and a good Gruyere and a good Reggiano and good heavy cream and salt and freshly ground black pepper. And that's it. So those are two side dishes for the guinea fowl.
So
when what would you?
Are you supposed to have both?
Well, I would. No.
Somewhere in America, the green vegetable farmers
are
sending us boycott emails. Don't send those to me. Send those to the attention of Chef Cindy Wolf.
So what I would suggest.
FormanWolf@WIPR.org.
Oh, gosh. What I would suggest are English peas and fava
beans. Is that
a
starch or a vegetable? Both.
English peas.
You're just going to get in further trouble. When we come back on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll do a chef challenge, maybe even a revenge challenge. I may have to give you the revenge challenge from the Green Vegetable Growers of America. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I was very hungry listening to the guinea fowl process. Mm-hmm. I have a need for those birds from time to time.
They're pretty good.
Flavor is really singular. It's a remarkable thing. Mm-hmm. That's.
What would you drink with that dish? With the vegetables.
You want something to cut something rich. Guinea fowl I always seem to want with mushrooms. And when the flavor's really developed on that bird, whether it's a really good pan sauce or if it's with mushrooms, if you're sneaky and you tuck a little bit of truffle under the skin on that bird, it's funny. I think I've done it where I had little slivers of truffle, almost like a clove, that I tucked into the knee joint and then wrapped the knee joint over, and it just like perfumes the entire leg just from that one sort of stud.
So what wine?
I usually want Bordeaux, the Merlot-based Bordeaux. Saint-Emilion Pomerol can be terrific. You need some bottle aged. Mm-hmm. You don't need that much tannin for it. But in a perfect world, Pomerol.
Okay. Should we do a chef's challenge?
We should. We should do a fun one.
Okay. Here, you go first.
That's so nice. Three courses prepared at a friend's house.
Those are your instructions.
Meaning?
That's it.
Meaning?
You just have to cook it at a friend's house.
Do I get to
You're
bring,
not cooking it at your house.
Do I get to bring my knives?
Yes, of course.
Sometimes their knives are really...
Yeah, I would definitely bring my knives.
And like a cutting...
And frankly, a cutting board.
A cutting board.
And some pans.
A couple of towels. A few pans. A couple of ringer pans.
Yeah, I guess it depends on who the friend is. This is a normal friend.
Well, it's a friend that I like. I would not be going to cook for them otherwise. And this is what's available. And is this friend a vegetarian? No, they're not.
Until the last ingredient.
Because there's a rabbit at the end of it. Okay. I was like, okay. Let's see. Well, there are two buffalo milk mozzarella. This is not revenge. This is nice. I love buffalo milk mozzarella. Ooh, asparagus. Are we assuming that the season has changed?
Yes. It's just whenever. Yeah, I'm not going with something current. I put tomatoes on there and scratched them out a couple of times. So, yeah. We're almost in asparagus season. It's not too far off.
You're in that terrible almost spring Chef Opal place.
Right.
There is a dish that I love to make with really good extra virgin olive oil, fresh buffalo milk mozzarella, and asparagus has been poached, blanched really, and seasoned and chilled, and just fresh mint and a little tiny bit of fresh chive. And that would be a great first course, just as simple as that is. I would have that as an antipasti. You have arborio rice here. Make a risotto for primo. Make a risotto. You have artichokes on here and basil. That sounds like a very nice risotto to me. There's also a rabbit. Now, if I had the time, I guess it depends how much time I have for cooking and how much wine everyone wants to be drinking while I cook really slowly. Because sometimes I'm really slow. I'm doing too much thinking and not enough production. Hmm. Might also be because some consumption involved in that.
Yeah.
Well, but
it's supposed to be fun.
No, it should be fun. That definitely helps make it fun. The rabbit, maybe some of the organ meat, like the livers, use that for get them nice and crispy, and use that for a garnish for the risotto, with the artichoke risotto finished with basil and the crispy livers from the rabbit. Otherwise, the rabbit, I would want to just roast it in quarters. Maybe, literally like alla mattone, where you bone out the rib cage and you can get it flat.
Mm-hmm.
And you cook it between two hot pans. Alla mattone means literally, they often think of pollo al mattone, which is chicken under a brick, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you put it in an oven in a pan under a brick. Well, I'm not going to use a brick. But maybe if I brought two pans that are companionable for this, I can get them smoking hot, which is what you're supposed to, have the rabbit season really, really well, and sear it really nicely in those pans. And then I have a variety of vegetables. It gave me all kinds of stuff to play with. Carrots, parsnips, fingerling potatoes. That's a nice little trio for a garnish. The cilantro I have not used. I don't know that I will. I can make a Granny Smith apple salad. I really want to make a Granny Smith apple and Niçoise olive relish. She gave me those two things. Make it kind of a salad or a relish with those two and the haricot vert. And what I really want for that is just like citrus or good old vinegar, maybe like sherry vinegar, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's some hiding in their cabinet, perhaps. But that I get a couple of dishes from that then. And the rabbit, the thing is, once you have it flat like that and all crispy, and then you turn the heat down and just kind of roast between those pans, and you rest it for a while, almost to room temperature, and then cut it into the quarters, and those have amazing flavor. It's rabbit on the bone. It's obviously use a knife, but honestly, this is a use your fingers kind of thing. You have all the side dishes of the veggies. You already had your risotto. You already had the mozzarella with that first asparagus.
That sounds good.
Yeah, I provided zero dessert, and you probably just need a magnum of some nice barbaresco to get you through the end of it, and a nice bottle of suave to get you started on the asparagus and mozzarella.
Suave.
So hopefully I brought those in my trunk as well as the as the pens and the knives. That's a nice challenge. That's not
You were the one that said revenge challenge. Well, I didn't say that.
I almost
so I'm a little bit worried.
Yeah, you should. You might want to be. I almost took you back to the convenience store.
Oh no, no.
But you have two different situations here, and you can do one of the two. There's a line between the two, or you can do both. Or honestly, if you wanted to trade back and forth, I'd be really impressed.
What? Oh, Tony.
Oh, I love when you read them and
Tony,
you say what?
Tony. Oh, my goodness.
So there's one scenario.
Uh-huh.
This is prepared.
I'm not doing that one.
At a friend's house.
Okay. Just so you all know what I'm looking at. Bologna, kosher hot dogs, pimenton.
Yeah.
Okay, which is actually good. Neutral oil.
Kosher hot dogs are really good.
It says potato rolls, but that's not what I thought it said. So potato rolls, which is funny. Hot Chinese mustard, barbecue sauce, kimchi or sauerkraut, and a dozen eggs. Yeah.
So,
and the one on the bottom says...
What you're not making are awesome hot dogs with pimenton stuffed hard-boiled eggs, you know, devil
is
eggs.
That what I'm not doing?
You're not doing.
Thank you, Tony, for figuring out
kimchi,
your...
It's what I wanted to eat. I'm sorry.
Okay. And then the other one says beet greens, dandelion greens... Blue Russian kale, Chioga beets, Brussels sprouts, fiddlehead ferns, new potatoes, spring garlic, hedgehog mushrooms, butter, one something something, and cordless cheese.
Okay. Allow me to,
what's cordless
allow me
cheese,
to help you.
Sorry.
Cordobes cheese.
Cordobes cheese, which I don't know what that is either.
It is also cordless.
Yeah.
Cordobes is a sheep's milk cheese from Spain that's kind of like a fresh
that
cheese.
That sounds good. Okay.
That can be quite good.
All right.
The one something something is also known as a ripe pear.
Okay. So the cheese and the pear go together.
This is
nice.
Vegetable farmers and vegetarians of America unite sort of challenge.
So I guess that means I don't have any ham or pork product.
That's pretty
when
likely.
When I see the dandelion beet greens and the blue Russian kale, it really makes me want to cook it with pork.
I gave you butter.
Well, thank goodness for that. So the dandelion beet and blue Russian kale, I'm going to wash it really well, stack it, roll it, chiffonade it. So that means cutting it across in a thin strip, if you will. And I'm going to toss that with the spring garlic, which actually I'm gonna put a little bit of oil in a pan. Did I dream that you gave me neutral oil?
I did.
Okay.
You can choose your neutral oil.
Oh, goody.
The
so
Switzerland
I'm going to put a
little
corn oil, from Switzerland in my pan, and I'm going to toss around the spring garlic, so I'm going to cut it on a dramatic bias, nice and long and skinny, toss that around, add the dandelion beet and Russian kale greens, and I'm going to have my chioga beets roasting in the oven while all this is going on, and they will be almost done by now. And... Okay. And so I'm going to make a salad with the beets and the greens. So the beets will actually add inherent sweetness to the dish. I love chioga beets. So roast them on a bed of kosher salt with foil, and it takes a very long time until they're tender. And then peel them, and I usually use a dish towel to take the skin off. And slice those and lay them out on the plate, dress them with a little bit of that neutral oil, a tiny bit of salt and pepper, and then just add the wilted greens to the center of the plate. With the fiddlehead ferns, I think that goes really well with the new potatoes. So if you cook the new potatoes whole in water that's heavily, heavily salted, and then drain them and then put them back in that pot with a little bit more salt and put the lid on it and let it sit for a little while, then I'm going to, again, lightly saute the fiddlehead ferns and a little bit of retain a little bit of the garlic, spring garlic, and I'll saute those in butter just for fun because now we have a different flavor. And add the hedgehog mushrooms. So the mushrooms should be pretty fine, chopped fine. Which is kind of unusual thing to do to hedgehogs. Toss those in the pan at the end with fiddleheads and then pull the potatoes out, cut them in half, and lay them on the plate and have the fiddlehead ferns and the hedgehog mushrooms with a little bit of butter as a garnish. And the Brussels sprouts I haven't used, so I think that's okay to go ahead and add to that dish. I would just to blanch them, cut them into quarters, and add those at the end. And then for dessert, I would have the beautiful sheep's milk Spanish. You said it was Spanish cheese?
Cordoba, yeah, Cordoba. Yeah.
And a little bit of ripe pear, and have that for dessert, which is my kind of dessert.
So that's very reasonable.
That's it.
The idea of the Brussels sprouts, the new potatoes and the
fiddleheads. And the mushrooms
all,
together.
And the mushrooms all warm in a dish.
Like, that sounds pretty, like the, pretty yummy.
Yeah, just like the very beginning of spring.
Yeah, that, and maybe a little, good. If I, you know, I don't have rosemary on the list, but I probably would have just added a couple pieces of rosemary to that just to toss around and then remove before plate up just to perfume the dish a little bit, or even a little bit of fresh English thyme. You know, again, just the whole stem with the leaves and just toss and remove it.
I thought on the salad you might go hunting through someone's cabinets to see what it is that you could rob for the
greens.
For the dressing, for the greens.
Greens, yeah. Well, it would have been nice to have had some good olive oil.
But that the beets and the greens and the other greens would be a terrific first course for a vegetarian main course. Has a little impact like that.
Okay, so
no
there
question.
You go.
Well, that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
You can download this broadcast or other podcasts from the WYPR website. Go to WYPR.org and look for the Foreman Wolf page. If you want to contact us, email us, ask questions, send comments, it's ForemanWolf@WYPR.org. If you want to contact Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
on Twitter @ChefCindyWolf or on Instagram @ChefWolf.
Thanks so much for listening.
And have a great Sunday.